Hey guys, it's Emma
and Shannon,
and welcome back to our podcast, She's an Engineer.
Thanks for tuning in this week. In today's episode, we're going to talk about earthquakes and volcanoes. And this episode was prompted by the most recent earthquake experienced in New York City and New York State. And also, we recently got an earthquake in Boise, Idaho, too, about a month and a half ago now. So after these most recent events, we decided to look a little bit more into earthquakes and volcanoes. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about what causes earthquakes and also information about volcanoes and when they are triggered, along with the most recent volcanic eruptions and some of the more major earthquakes experienced in the U.S.
Yeah, so I'll start us off with what causes earthquakes and what are earthquakes. So earthquakes are triggered by a variety of processes, which include volcanic eruptions, landslides, and even meteor strikes. But the most common cause of earthquakes lies deep below our feet in the form of plate tectonics. And so sandwiched between the atmosphere above and the asthenosphere below, which is the upper layer of the Earth's mantle, lies the outermost layer of the Earth, which is the lithosphere. And litho usually just means like rock. And this layer consists of numerous pieces or plates that jostle around on top of the asthenosphere like an energetic jigsaw puzzle. And temperatures in the asthenosphere range from 2,370 degrees Fahrenheit to 3,090 degrees Fahrenheit. And the depth ranges from 62 miles to 155 miles below Earth's surface. The high temperatures result in this asthenosphere layer having enough elasticity to flow, basically despite being solid. This ductile layer can flow slowly under heat convection and help move magma and rocks through the earth, and they contribute to the movement of tectonic plates.
When two tectonic plates attempt to move past each other, friction prevents them from gliding on with relative ease, causing stress to build up at the point of contact. Though their movement is hindered, the plates never stop moving, so ultimately something has to give. Eventually, the rock slips, releasing vast amounts of energy in waves that travel through Earth's interior to the surface and generate the shaking we perceive during an earthquake. The point on the Earth's surface that lies directly above the focus of the earthquake is known as the epicenter. Earthquakes can arise anywhere between Earth's surface and around 700 kilometers deep, according to the USGS. They're prevalent along the edges of plate boundaries, and according to the British Geological Survey, over 80% occur around the edge of the Pacific Ocean, and this area is also known as the Ring of Fire. Some earthquakes, however, can appear far from the boundaries, right in the middle of a plate. These are known as intraplate quakes, and although little is known about them, some scientists believe that they result from pre-existing faults that formed within Earth's crust a long time ago.
So next, we're going to discuss how earthquakes are measured. And so earthquakes are usually measured with a seismograph or a seismometer. That's an instrument that's used to detect and measure ground movements that are caused by seismic activity. And so a seismogram is that record of the ground movements. And a simple seismometer basically consists of a pen attached to a suspended mass, which, when the ground moves, will move due to its inertia, and they'll record the movements on a rotating drum of paper. More sophisticated seismometers record the motion of the ground in three dimensions. So it records it up and down, east to west, and also north to south. And scientists can use this data to calculate the size of the earthquake or the magnitude of the earthquake. And the Richter scale is the most well-known way of actually measuring an earthquake's magnitude and was developed in 1935 by Charles F. Richter. And he originally designed it to compare the size of earthquakes in the California region. This scale, the Richter scale, goes from 1 to 10. And when you go from 1 to 2, one increase in the scale accounts for a tenfold increase in the magnitude. So it's logarithmic. The magnitude of the earthquake relates to the amplitude, which is the distance from the center line to the top of the crest or bottom of the trough of a wave, of the waves recorded by the seismograph. There's one problem with this technique, though, which is that earthquake wave amplitudes are not only affected by the earthquake itself, but also by the distance between the seismometer and the epicenter, and even the type of rock that the waves are traveling through. And therefore, various adjustments need to be made to seismometer data to account for the variation in conditions so that the calculated magnitude is the same regardless of where it was measured. So this is basically saying that, like, let's say you're a specific distance from the, like, the epicenter of the earthquake, you might on a seismometer measure a different amplitude of the wave because it's measuring, like, the distance comes into calculation as well if you were measuring from a different point. So they need to find some way to, like, equalize that so that it doesn't matter where you're measuring from, because you obviously there's no way to know whether or not you're going to measure exactly from the epicenter of of the earthquake.
Also, something interesting is the Richter scale doesn't actually have an upper limit. Although we currently have the Richter scale from 1 to 10, that's only because we've never experienced an earthquake higher than 10. But technically, it could go higher.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And as more and more seismometers were installed around the world, it became incredibly difficult to adjust the data to make it fit the Richter scale, as it became apparent that the scale only worked for certain frequency and distance ranges, which was according to the USGS. Scientists therefore came up with a new scale that can be used all around the world called the moment magnitude. The moment refers to the amount of energy released at the time of slip on the fault multiplied by the area of the fault surface affected. It can be estimated using seismometers, and it's related to the total energy released in the earthquake. Moment magnitude is the most reliable estimate of earthquake size. The effect of an earthquake on Earth's surface, also known as the intensity, is evaluated with the modified Mercalli MM intensity scale. The scale is rather ambiguous as it's not based on numerical values, but instead assigns a ranking based on observable effects. This could be misleading, as two earthquakes of the same magnitude striking two areas with different levels of earthquake preparedness or different geological compositions would result in the assignment of very different intensity rankings.
All right, and now that we've talked more about earthquakes, we're going to move on to talking about volcanoes. So let's start with, like, what are volcanoes and what causes these volcanoes to erupt? So volcanoes are both the events where molten rock material and volcanic gases are erupted from within Earth's interior, and also the cones and the mountains built up around these vents. So, like, if you can imagine, the vent is basically, like, if you've ever seen a video of a volcano erupting, the vent is basically that, like, hole where the, like, the steam or the magma or, like, the lava is coming out of. And then the cone and mountain is basically, like, that mountain or, like, hill or whatever is, like, surrounding the volcano. Like, whatever you feel like is, like, that structure of, like, the volcano, usually it looks like a cone. So, like, if you've ever built, like, a volcano diorama or, like, something like that for, like, a school fair, then it would be, like, the outside of the part is the cone or the mountain. And then that hole from which, like, your fake lava is coming from would be the vent. Yeah. But beyond this simple definition, volcanoes are incredibly diverse, with some types being actually very complex. And some volcanoes actually make up the largest mountains on the planet, while others are small hills that might only be a few hundred feet tall. Some volcanoes erupt multiple times over periods of hundreds of thousands of years, while others only experience one single eruptive episode and then remain like dormant, as you would call it. And so let's talk a little bit about the structure of a volcano, or like the anatomy of the volcano, basically. So first, we talked about vents, which are the openings at the surface where volcanic eruptions occur. And then there are also conduits, which are the channelways that lead from the magma reservoir to the vent. And these are the only features that all volcanoes have. So some types of volcanoes are exclusively made of deposits of volcanic ash and other types of tephra, and others are nearly wholly made of lava flows. Some contain both pyroclastic deposits and lava flows, and possibly also have lava domes, lahar, and or landslide deposits.
Depending on how they're grouped or subdivided, there are 8 different types of volcanoes based on their size, shape, eruption style and classification, and type slash composition of magma erupted. 3 types of volcanoes are cylinder cones, composite volcanoes, and shield volcanoes, and these are the most common and well known. But examples of all 8 volcanoes can be found in the national parks. Deep within the earth, it is so hot that some rocks slowly melt and become a thick, flowing substance called magma. Since it is lighter than the solid rock around it, magma rises and collects in magma chambers. Eventually, some of the magma pushes through the vents and fissures to the Earth's surface. Magma that has been erupted is called lava. Some volcanic eruptions are explosive and others are not. The explosivity of an eruption depends on the composition of the magma. If magma is thin and runny, gases can escape easily from it. When this type of magma erupts, it flows out of the volcano. A good example of this type of eruption is at the Hawaii volcanoes. Lava flows rarely kill people because they move slowly and people are able to move out of the way. If magma is thick and sticky, gases cannot escape easily, which pressure then builds up until the gases escape and violently explode. A good example of this type of eruption is Washington's Mount St. Helens. In this type of eruption, the magma blasts into the air and breaks apart into pieces called tephra. Tephra can range in size from tiny particles of ash to house-sized boulders. Explosive volcanic eruptions can be dangerous and deadly. They can blast out of clouds of hot tephra from the side or top of volcano. These fiery clouds race down mountainsides, destroying almost everything in their path. Ash erupted into the sky falls back down to earth like powdery snow, and if thick enough, the blankets of ash can suffocate plants, animals, and humans. When hot volcanic materials mix with water from streams or melted snow and ice, mud flows form, and the mud flows have buried entire communities located near erupting volcanoes.
Yeah, this sounds like the
Pompeii.
Mount Vesuvius eruption.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay. And then going back to earthquakes, we're going to talk a little bit about like fun facts about earthquakes in the U.S. and like the history of like large earthquakes in the U.S. So the largest recorded earthquake in the U.S. was a magnitude of 9.2 that actually struck the Prince William Sound in Alaska on Good Friday, March 28th, 1964. Hmm. And the earliest reported earthquake in California was actually felt in 1769 by the exploring expedition of Gaspar de Portola while the group was camping about 48 kilometers southeast of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. The average rate of motion across the San Andreas Fault Zone during the past 3 million years is 56 millimeters per year, which is equivalent to 2 inches per year. That's quite large.
Yes.
This is the same rate as which your fingernails grow. Assuming this rate continues, scientists project that Los Angeles and San Francisco will be adjacent to one another in approximately 15 million years. Each year, the Southern California area has about 10,000 earthquakes. Most of them are so small they are not felt. Only several hundred are greater than magnitude 3.0 on the Richter scale, and only about 15 to 20 are greater than magnitude 4.0. If there is a large earthquake, however, the aftershock sequence will produce many more earthquakes of all magnitudes for many months.
And I know we think a lot about earthquakes in California because that's where we think the most earthquakes happen. But there's actually lots of earthquakes in lots of other regions that get lots of earthquakes. So the Wasatch Range, which also has a lot of good ski areas, runs north to south through Utah. And like all mountain ranges, it was produced actually by a series of earthquakes. The 386-kilometer long Wasatch Fault is made of several segments, each capable of producing up to a magnitude of 7.5 earthquake. And during the past 6,000 years, there's been a magnitude of 6.5 plus about once every 350 years. And it's been about 350 years since the last powerful earthquake, which was on the Nephi segment. So if you think about it, if it's been once every 350 years, we're kind of due for another one.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I'm located in Idaho, somewhat near this area. And I actually wanted to mention some facts about where I'm currently living because growing up in the Midwest, we rarely experienced earthquakes. I think my first 18 years of life, I only experienced one earthquake. But since moving out here in 2021, I've experienced two larger earthquakes. And then many very small earthquakes you don't even notice. But something interesting is that Idaho experienced its largest earthquake ever in 2020. And it occurred on March 31st, 2020. And it was a 6.5 on the Richter scale. Oh, this was the second largest earthquake in Idaho. And ever since that event in 2020, the region of Idaho I'm in, near Stanley, Idaho, which was like the epicenter of that earthquake, has just experienced a lot of very small earthquakes in the past 4 years. And I thought that was kind of interesting that this like one big earthquake then started a bunch of mini earthquakes that occur pretty often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you think a lot about the aftershock of an earthquake, like you think it's going to happen like right away after the earthquake. So for example, like on Friday, we had, I think it was a 4.8 magnitude earthquake here where I'm living in New Jersey, and the epicenter was in Lebanon, New Jersey, but it was felt obviously like through Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania, and in New York and New Jersey. And we did feel an aftershock, which was about, I want to say, a couple hours later, like 5 hours later. But if you think about it, like a big earthquake like causing an aftershock of little earthquakes, that can happen over the course of like many, many years. Like,
yes.
It's not an immediate thing. So basically, an aftershock results from the sudden change in stress that occurs within and between rocks and the previous release of stress that was brought on by the principal earthquake. So that like main earthquakes. And aftershocks normally occur in rocks located near the epicenter or at the fault which harbored the principal earthquake.
Interesting.
So that's how an aftershock comes about. And then also there are some states that don't really experience earthquakes in the U.S. And from 1975 to 1995, a period of 20 years, there were only 4 states in the U.S. that didn't have any earthquakes within that period of time. So these states were Florida, Iowa, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, which are mostly, aside from Florida, in like the mid or like center region of the U.S.
That's interesting because I feel like the Midwest might be a good place in the case that a lot of natural disasters keep happening that everyone might flock to. Because even though Florida hasn't had many earthquakes, they have a lot of hurricanes, but the Midwest is kind of safe from a lot of natural disasters.
That is true.
Earthquakes do occur in the central portion of the U.S. Some powerful earthquakes occurred along the New Madrid Fault in Mississippi Valley in 1811 to 1812. Because of the crustal structure in the central U.S., which efficiently propagates seismic activity, shaking from earthquakes in this part of the country is felt at a much greater distance than from the epicenters of similar size quakes in the western U.S.
Interesting.
Similar to Emma's fact before, Florida and North Dakota have the least number of earthquakes in the United States. And The state with the most earthquakes is Alaska. It's one of the most seismically active regions of the world, and Alaska experiences a magnitude 7 earthquake almost every year and a magnitude 8 or greater earthquake on average every 14 years.
Wow, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about Alaska before we started researching for this episode, because you always think that the most earthquake-prone state is California, but I imagine that's because, like, that's what, like, the news probably covers, because there's more people in California, so, like, more people are probably affected than in Alaska.
Yeah, and something related to this is actually for your professional engineering exam. If you're going for a civil engineering PE, the only state, I think, right now that requires you to do an extra seismic test is California. They have, like, an extra test on a second day to get your PE.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. And now we're going back to volcanoes after talking about earthquakes. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the history of volcano eruptions in the U.S. and also just about, like, active volcanoes in the U.S. So we're going to only really talk about volcanoes that don't have, like, steam eruptions. So we're going to talk about active volcanoes without steam eruptions. So Mount St. Helens in Washington. So eruptions and or lava dome growth has occurred in the late 1700 from 1800 to 1857, 1980 to 1986, as well as 2008 to 2004, which is quite recent. Yeah. And then there's also another volcano called Lassen Peak in California. Basically, it had a series of steam blasts that began on May 30th, 1914. And then an eruption occurred 12 months later on May 21st, 1915. And then minor activity continued through the middle of 1917, but hasn't had any activity since. And then the last one that I'll talk about is Mount Hood in Oregon. And Mount Hood was actually dormant for over 1,000 years. But then in 1781, it had an eruptive period that began for about a decade. And then going forward to the mid-1800s, local residents actually reported minor explosive activity of Mount Hood in Oregon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm currently living in a location with a bunch of volcanoes around me, along with these Yellowstone super volcano.
Yeah.
Okay. So though very few people in the United States may actually experience an erupting volcano, the evidence for earlier volcanism is preserved in many rocks of North America. Features seen in volcanic rocks only hours old are present in ancient volcanic rocks, both at the surface and buried beneath younger deposits. A thick ash deposit sandwiched between layers of sandstone in Nebraska, the massive granite peaks of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, and a variety of volcanic layers found within eastern Maine are but a few of the striking clues of the past volcanic activity. With this perspective, an erupting volcano is not only an exciting and awesome spectacle in its own right, but a window into the natural process that has happened over and over again throughout Earth's history. The United States ranks third behind Indonesia and Japan in the number of historically active volcanoes, and that is for which we have written accounts of eruptions. In addition, about 10% or more of the 1,500 volcanoes that have erupted in the past 10,000 years are located in the U.S. Most of the volcanoes are found in the Aleutian Islands, the Alaska Peninsula, the Hawaiian Islands, and the Cascade Range of the Pacific Northwest. The remainder are widely distributed in the western part of the nation. A few volcanoes in the U.S. have produced some of the largest and most dangerous types of eruptions in this century, while others have threatened to erupt.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You wouldn't think of, like, the U.S. as being a big volcanic, like, area, but it is, I guess.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. I guess the moral of the story is that you're near a lot of different prone to natural disaster areas if you live in the Pacific Northwest.
That is true. Very true.
But I guess if you live in the Midwest, you're also prone to tornadoes. So I don't know.
Oh, mm-hmm. That is a very good point, because growing up, I knew we did tornado drills all the time, but I was never exposed to earthquake drills, which is something very common out here.
Really? We don't have, I think, either. I don't think we have tornado drills or earthquake drills. I think we were taught on what to do if, like, I think, like, there was one time we were taught in, like, elementary school to, like, go under a desk or something if there's a earthquake, and to also do that if there was a tornado. But I think that's the only thing we learned. Like, I don't really think that tornadoes really happen in the New Jersey area. And although we did just have like a pretty big earthquake, I mean, not that big, but it was like 4.8. There's not that many earthquakes that also happen in this area. From what I can remember, there's been like 3 that have happened like in my lifetime. So.
Wow. Well, for those of you that grew up in the Midwest, then you know that for tornadoes, we would just have to do eggshell position in the hallway. So we'd go to like a hallway with no windows and just like put our heads against the wall, eggshell position, cover our necks with our hand, and just like stay in that position.
Oh, wow. And how often did you have these drills?
Oh, I mean, at least once or twice a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. But yeah, the more you know. I guess anywhere you are in the U.S., you're kind of prone to some sort of natural disaster. Like, it's not like you're going to be, there's any area I think that you're like free of natural disaster.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It's good to know if you're traveling too.
Yeah, you could always have like wildfires and stuff if you're near large forests, like anything like that. But I think like specifically for like natural disasters, the Pacific Northwest and I think the California region sound like not a great place to be.
Well, it's like, it's hard because there's so much cool nature out here because we have the Rocky Mountains and we have like a lot of mountain ranges that comes with more natural disasters. So that's, they kind of come hand in hand.
Yeah. You can't have one but not the other.
Yeah.
All right. We hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We might do some follow-up at some point on other natural disasters or just like all the specific volcanoes in the U.S., but there's not enough time in this episode to do that. But let us know if there's any other type of topic about natural disasters that you would like us to cover. And we'll see you guys again in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.